revise the order of our posted program for the morning to accommodate some members, and we will be opening with hearings on some of the bills. Somewhere around 9 o'clock, we will get to the executive appointments. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2757. And Bob Cantine
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Cantine. I'm with the Association of Oregon County. And there are two bills here that are
related.
Joined together and related, so I would like to comment on both, if that would be okay.
That's fine. Let's go ahead and open the hearing on HCR 28 as well, and that way we're on the record.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chair, I'd like to speak in support of HCR 28. It was amended in the House so that it actually, I think, will be an improvement over existing law. The general proposition, it would tighten up considerably the ability to create new counties from within existing counties, because it sets new population parameters and makes it just generally more difficult to do that. So we are supportive of that. On the other hand, House Bill 2757 is the change in how that law would be applied. That is, how do you then create a new county out of an existing county? What are the steps? And what are the voting requirements? And currently the law provides that if you are going to create a new county out of an existing county, that your election requires a 65% vote of the electors in the new area to be created into a county, and a 35% majority of the electors in the original county outside of that new area. And I think that was there for a reason, because what the one area does certainly involves and affects the other area. And this bill would make not only a change where the only requirement is to have a vote in the new area to be created, but reduces that vote from 65% down to 50%, a simple majority. And I think, although I know that the proponents say this applies only to Multnomah County and their situation, as a general public policy, I think it is improper or not the best approach to have it where there's simple majority required only in the new area to be created. Over the long haul, it could also apply to other areas. Currently, I think it could certainly apply to Lane County and Eugene, if that should ever, you know, what you have is a disaffected area. And we run into those all the time where communities are upset with the county and they want to change things and govern themselves, and we get into these kinds of conflicts, and you don't know who's going to spring up next. I know that it would be possible in Lane County, marginally possible here in Marion County, eventually would probably be possible in Beaverton and Washington County. Certainly the county's population is big enough to accommodate the creation of a new county if Beaverton reaches 100,000 in the future. So I would just ask the committee to take a look at this issue, because I think it's a major fundamental decision when you separate two areas that have been joined as a single county. And the fact that you require a supermajority in one area and a 35% majority in the other, I think requires them to sit down and talk about that in advance to try and work out something that is acceptable to both parties, or at least enough to get the required vote. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'd be glad to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Cantine.
looking at the language here, I see where they've made the change from 65% registered within the limits of proposed new county to a majority of all electors. That is a 50% of all registered electors in that
new area.
In that new area.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. And previously, that was 65% in that new area, and then a 35% majority in the original county, remaining original county outside of the new area. It had to have a 35% majority of the electors. So you had to have both of those occur together.
So it's not just those who turn out to vote, but the number is actually of the total registered electors. Am I reading that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Further questions? Thank you very much. I'll Judith. Matt McClure and Larry Harvey.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Larry Harvey. I'm here this morning on behalf of the City of Gresham. Before I offer any comments or remarks, though, I'm going to let Judith Ewer, who is with the City Manager's Office of the City of Gresham, and allow her to go first. She can probably best outline for you the rationale behind this particular piece of legislation, which is not really new. This body, or the 69th legislative body, actually took a look at this last session and won its approval, but we simply ran out of time towards the end of session. But Judith will again go through some of the points of the legislation and also clarify a couple of things that Mr. Cantine spoke to, and then I'll conclude.
Good morning, Chair Sparb, Senator Courtney. You have before you today Resolution 28 and its companion bill, House Bill 2757. Together, these bills help address an issue that has faced East Moline.
Excuse me. Did you identify yourself on the record?
I'm sorry. Larry did here. Judith Ewer, I'm with the City of Gresham and representing them today. Again, you have House Joint Resolution 28 and House Bill 2757, which together will allow East Moline County citizens to address an issue that's faced them over and over again. These bills were raised as a result of consolidation discussions between the City of Portland and Multnomah County. Consolidation of services between Multnomah County and Portland has been discussed in one form or another and within various committees, commissions, task forces, et cetera. I believe about 22 times since 1913. The issue does come up again and again and has come up fairly recently. Each time Multnomah County residents have had no choice but to be swept along with the tide when those discussions have occurred. The most recent round of discussions took place in late 1997 and early 1998. A multi-agency task force was formed to explore the creation of a Portland City County, which would merge the two existing jurisdictions of the City of Portland and Multnomah County. If accomplished, residents of Gresham, Troutdale, Fairview, Wood Village, and unincorporated Multnomah County would have had only two options, to be absorbed into the new county or to join another existing contiguous county. In our case, it would have been Clackamas County. At the conclusion of the task force's work, the concept of consolidation was once again set aside. However, at some future date, consolidation may very well make sense for the City of Portland and Multnomah County. If so, the combination of HJR 28 and HB 2757 provides a safety net for our community as well as allows consolidation to take place unimpeded if, in fact, Portland and Multnomah County wish to do so. If passed by voters, HJR 28 would allow a new county to be formed with an area of less than 400 square miles geographically and only if the included population exceeds 100,000 and an equal or greater number would be retained in the existing county. These conditions exist actually in five counties in Oregon at this time rather than just one. It's Multnomah County, Washington, Clackamas, Lane, and Marion as well. HB 2757 ensures that only those residents who are affected by the change would have responsibility for making this decision. It's an issue of self-determination for our citizens. As proposed, the legislation doesn't negatively impact existing counties. The greatest effect would be a shift of tax revenue if new county were formed. However, since the cost to serve the affected citizens would also be transferred to the new county, the long-term effect should be neutral. Other financial issues related to disposition of assets, such as buildings, roads, and other public facilities, would, of course, need to be negotiated between the participating agencies. I think it's important to note that the City of Gresham and the other East Multnomah County cities have no immediate desire to secede from Multnomah County. And even if they did, it would take a majority of all the consolidated populations of all four cities to actually make that happen. There may be other reasons why forming a new county might be an attractive idea to some community. In our case, compression may someday be an issue, or our citizens may wish to have a stronger voice in determining their service levels. If so, we hope that the choice of forming a new county will be one more option available to us. And I thank you for considering these issues, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Questions? Not we chair recognizes Representative Clary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Courtney, I think all has been said that needs to be said really about this. Certainly a good explanation. And I don't know if coming down here from Judiciary, if you had a chance to mention the letter from the City Council. It is not the intention to do this aggressively, but to have a fallback position in the event that the City and the County choose to do this. So this is not a piece of legislation where we're going to go out and attempt to change the county immediately.
Very, very well.
In conclusion, Harvey here, again, Larry Harvey, Senator Courtney. I think Representative Terry pointed out the only other issue that I wanted to make sure was on the record for the committee before they make any decision. It is somewhat ironic that the only opposition argument that's ever been presented to House Bill 2757 is with all due respect to my colleague from the Association of Oregon Counties, it's an issue of whether or not folks would have the right to self-determination. And it just seems rather ironic that a group of citizens who decide that they would rather govern themselves should decide that they should vote on that collectively and by majority election would determine their own self-government. If that argument holds up within this committee, then I suppose it probably would have held up when the original 13 colonies decided they wanted to separate from England, too. And so beyond that, I don't know that there are really any other issues to cover for this committee.
The point made was that a separation would affect those that you leave behind in the original county, and they've been removed from any consideration or participation in the vote. How do you answer that?
Mr. Chair, my answer to that would be that the impact, by and large, would be that the billion-dollar retirement for police and fire the City of Portland has chosen to establish for themselves, and the billion-dollar sewer project that the City of Portland yet faces, that would be the impact. But the fact is that the City of Gresham and other cities in East County have already shouldered that responsibility themselves. We've already paid for our sewer projects and throughout our neighborhoods. We've also determined to put our retirement plan in PERS. So that would, in fact, have an impact, an adverse impact on the people in the City of Portland. But then that's exactly what the people in East County want to get away from, having to be responsible for that a second time. And I think it would be inappropriate that we have a situation established where some 1 million voters in the greater Portland area would never allow the couple hundred thousand people to be able to leave that situation. So in the sense of self-determination, it would be the people of East County that should have the right to be able to make that determination for themselves.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? If not, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2757. And HJR 28. And we will await the quorum of our committee for further deliberations.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I got to go to conference committee.
Aye.
Here to move the Conference Commission.
All right, thank you. Well,
we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3182 and call Representative Morissette.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Representative Bill Morissette, District 42, Springfield. And I appreciate the opportunity of hearing Ben Westland's bill, and I strongly support this bill because its goal is to make government spending more accountable. Ben was not able to be here this morning. He's in the Budget Committee. What I have is a proposed amendment, House Bill 3182-85, and like Representative Westland's bill, my proposed amendment is an attempt to make government more accountable by measuring the effectiveness of agency spending. This amendment would add a new section to HB 3182, and it does have the Representative Westland's support. Like HB 3182, this amendment has no financial impact because the cost can be absorbed within the existing budgets. If adopted, this amendment directs the Joint Legislative Audit Committee to select state agencies to participate in a pilot program to submit performance-based budgets to the governor and the Legislative Assembly for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2001. Selection of agencies and their performance measures would be assisted by the House and Senate interim committees having oversight responsibility for the selected agencies, as well as the Department of Administrative Services, the Division of Audits of the Secretary of State, and other agencies. This amendment was developed in consultation with the state's budgeting experts, including John Yonkers, Teresa McHugh, Director and Deputy Director, respectively, of the Departments of Administrative Services, John Latimer, Director of Audits Division, and Jeff Tryons of the Oregon Progress Board. This performance-based budget focuses on agencies' results. It uses quantifiable program performance measures to which agencies must link their budget requests and results. The performance measures are quantifiable outcomes that support the goals of the agency. Outcomes reflect effectiveness and results. So there are a list of examples of outcome performance measures. The benchmarks, okay, how does the performance-based budget differ from the Oregon Progress Board's benchmarks? Benchmarks measure Oregon's progress towards achieving its strategic plan called Oregon Shines. Benchmarks cross lines of agencies' responsibilities. They are not directly linked to specific agency budgets or results. So, I have some other information here, and I have John Latimer, Teresa McHugh here to answer questions. They were involved in setting this, establishing the program that we are talking about. I feel that it would be one step closer to truly doing performance-based budgeting. there is an interim committee that is already established that would oversee and help to guide the program, working closely with the agencies. I think it would be a step toward a goal that the agencies have had over a number of years, starting as far back as 1969 into the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So with that, I would answer questions or ask that you consider the amendment.
Sir, John, do you have anything you'd like to contribute, or how's this
But for the record, I'm Teresa McHugh, Deputy Director of the Department of Administrative Services. I would say we have worked on the parameters with Representative Morissette on how you would go through a pilot process. The state has had a lot of attempts at moving forward, I believe, in terms of getting more information of this sort. We do use it to some degree during our budget development and analysis, but in terms of it being used extensively in the legislative process, it hasn't been. So again, taking steps forward to do that is always a healthy process, and ultimately the real test will be what we learn through this process, working closely with the legislative branch on how do we want to develop budgets in the future. I would expect that there will be a lot of lessons that come out of a pilot that we would be coming back and talking to you about in terms of how would you actually go about implementing. We are also in the process of looking closely at several of our sister states in terms of what they're doing and both the cost of what they're doing as well as the benefits they have achieved, and that's one of our interim projects as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Latimer, Director of the Audits Division. When I speak to these issues, it's always difficult for me to not have my old hat on as a budget person and put on my audit hat, so I'll just sort of slide between the two. One of the things that people, I think, sometimes forget is that budgets are law. They're adopted session laws that last for only 2 years, but they are law. And when we audit against the law. If the budget itself is adopted in with a lot of language directing the agencies and in the performance that they need to have if they spend their dollars, then we can audit against that. If not, then it's more difficult for us to audit performance of the agencies. When I was in the budget process, we worked, and I worked with Teresa several biennia to try to come up with a way to provide performance-based budgeting. Problem is that it requires quite a bit of work on the part of the agencies. It requires resources. It requires commitment on the part of both the legislative branch and the executive branch. If you look at budget reforms in the past and the history of this country, you find that it's always been one or the other, the legislative branch or the executive branch, that have pushed budgeting reform. And the only place that it has worked and worked fairly well in places like Arizona and Florida and Texas is where there's been a commitment by both the governor and the legislature to do this. I think until we get that in Oregon, it's going to be very difficult to do. But in the meantime, a nice slow approach is to try a pilot project and see if the information provided to the legislature is the kind that you want to make decisions. After all, the budget process is a quintessential political process. And the more informed that process is, I think, the better. Answer any questions?
Thank you. Senator Barr.
Thank you. It's always interesting to see this thing come around and around all the time. I was taken by one of the Representative Morissette's comments that it's different than the benchmarks, and that the legislature hasn't paid any attention to the benchmarks. I suspect that's correct. I know that's true. There hasn't been hardly any interest at all on following up on them. We spent, as John and Teresa both know, we spent a lot of time on trying to figure out ways to connect and see what other states would do. in the, is it 96 in them, I guess it was. How do you see this as different? I mean, I look at what's in Westland's original bill and the difference, the prioritization and all that, and it looks like the zero-based budgeting that the state of Oregon adopted. In fact, it looks like the governor's budget instructions that were handed out before this legislative session, so there's nothing new there. But how do you think it would be different without Congress?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'll go first and let John follow up. I think the real issue is what John Latimer referred to. Is I think the real difference comes at the point of the commitment to really go forward and use the information. One of the things that the state will have to deal with at some point is to really go down this road, what are the necessary resources, both technology and people-wise, to gather how much information you end up wanting to have for this process. It may allow us to go a different route and gather just different information that's more useful. But I think the real issue is continuing to move forward and provide something and grapple with the issue of what information is useful to the decision-making process. I would say that obviously when we came forward and had performance measures coming into the budget hearing, and that was, I'm not going to even remember which session, but where the agencies not only developed them, but it was part of their budget presentation. But they ended up not being a useful part of that budget presentation. They ended up not, most agencies were not even asked to present them, or told, well, we'll get to that later. And they weren't used extensively in terms of the governor's preparation either. Now, it wasn't useful information to the decision-making process. So I think in terms of looking at this as a way of trying to deal with getting down to outcomes that are useful, that may be one of the differences. But again, I think the real issue comes to the commitment of following it through and seeing how to make it useful. The other difference is we will be looking at some of our, as I said, sister states, the ones that John mentioned, as well as some of their, what they have found. They have some successes and they have some failures in every one of those states where they have things that have worked well and things that they have not been able to achieve. So maybe part of this process is trying not to find a shoe that fits all and works every place, but really focusing in and coming up with some measures and some outcomes that are useful in specific places.
My perception, Teresa, is that actually the last two cycles that the governor has tried to in some way use the benchmarks in preparing his budget. Is that your observation, too?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we have been, in terms of our budget analysis and preparation, been provided to the governor an analysis of how well the agency is linked and how they look at their packages and say they're linked to benchmarks or what progress they've made, as well as what progress they've made against their own strategic plans and measures. So that has been part of the process, but again, not perhaps in a completely formal way, but it has been part of the governor's process.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, when we started this process, it was after having looked at the state of Florida and what they were attempting to do, and the first people that we talked to were the governor's budget office, John Yonkers, Teresa McHugh, and we would not have moved beyond that point if we had not had some encouragement or support. And what our goal is, the effort is to select three agencies within the larger departments in agencies that would lend themselves to a pilot project that would not necessarily be the easy ones, but that would provide the opportunity to come up with some different kinds of measures that everyone seems to think are lacking in the process right now. It's hard to measure outcomes. It's hard to, sometimes you have to look for risk factors if you're dealing with some of the human agencies and identify how well you deal with the risk factors. And those are some of the problems that I understand, you know, I'm talking with John Latimer, we've been wrestling with for years. So after talking with John Yonkers and Teresa McHugh, we talked to Phil Kiesling about, you know, his department's willingness to use the audit interim committee rather than create a new committee, and Phil was supportive and suggested that we talk to Mr. Latimer, which we did, and John was, as the others were, very cautious to start with, like, I've been here before, I've heard this many times, but did feel that there was some merit to it in trying a different approach on a limited basis that could be handled and absorbed in the departments. And so we felt that with the support of the administrative staff that this was something that we would like to see move forward and give it a shot.
Other questions? Director Barr?
Yeah. We kind of did that. I suspect one of the problems is that there's not in the past, I haven't looked at it this year, there's not a great overlap between the Legislative Audit Committee and the Ways and Means Committee. And it strikes me, if you're going to really make it work, if you want the Ways and Means Committee to pay attention to it, the information and the outcomes during their deliberative process on building the budget, they've got to be involved in the interim as the audit to following up on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee is chaired or co-chaired by the co-chairs of the Ways and Means Committee, so to the extent that there is some overlap, there's that. You do have a point, and I think it's a major point that I've tried to make when we've talked about this both now and in the past, that until you get a commitment from key members of the legislature as well as the governor, performance-based budgeting is never going to work because it's only going to be an artifact of the process and not a major player in the process. We in Oregon have what we refer to as a modified zero-based budget process. Zero-based budgeting is one of those many budget reform processes that didn't work well because it's so expensive in a very complex entity like a state government. It works well in a private business where you're only dealing with one program or two programs, but where you're dealing, like in state government, with 1,500 major programs, it's very difficult to do because it's very paper intensive, because you're looking at every building block in a budget and then trying to assess what it adds to state government. And it gets very expensive to do. So in Oregon, we've modified it, and Senator is correct. We do and have in the past used 90, even sometimes 80% budgets as the governor has proposed them. But in this case, this pilot project might give us an opportunity. And this would be the first time that the audit has been brought into it as an oversight agency to look at the actual performance measures and how the agencies do.
Other questions?
John, could you see tying that together with the benchmarks?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'm not sure. I think we can. I know that the problem with the benchmarks is that in the past they've been very broad and very difficult to measure, to provide measurable outcomes. To the extent that benchmarks are a broader target and we can develop then performance measures that get to that broader target, then there would be a relationship, yes.
There's nothing magical about performance or outcome measures. It's really based on how much time you spend at the start running through your assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that we think if we do this, this will happen, and figuring out and measuring that, seeing if it worked or not, and adjusting. And that strikes me as something that would tie very well with the benchmarks. We've got the benchmarks. We haven't done a very good job of going through, okay, so how do we address them, and figuring out whether those strategies worked or not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, one of the problems that when we try to do these kinds of things, we were penny-wise and pound foolish. We never put the resources into it to make it work. Measuring anything takes resources, and we tend not to do that because they take dollars away from programs, and every time you try to do a measurement, you're taking dollars away from some interest group, quite frankly, and they don't like it. And that's There's always that conflict between measuring outcomes and putting dollars into dollars you would use to measure the outcomes into the program you're trying to manage it.
And I guess what we get into, the normal budgeting is not whether what you're doing is effective or not, it's whether you were efficient in spending your money.
That's correct.
You envision that this program is, or this pilot study is going to be absorbed in the budget? Or we have not a referral to Ways and Means for funding of this pilot?
Mr. Chair, at this point, no. On a pilot basis, we can absorb that. I think the bottom line, as we look at it as an executive branch, is we always struggle with this process is dependent upon the information that comes to it. And anything that causes us, and even if this works great, there will be things that can be better. But we have to continue to look at better ways to get information to the governor and to the legislature in a timely and organized fashion that helps the decision-making process. So in terms of looking at this as a pilot, we believe we can afford that. Again, at the point where if this works great, we say, boy, we want to do this statewide, we probably have to have a visit about what does that mean and how do we deal with that.
It doesn't matter if our performance-based budgeting in this Pierce form doesn't really make sense for a lot of state programs. I mean, for a lot of them, this activity measurement makes sense. Maintaining the road system, I mean, there's nothing great performance about that. You either pave it or you don't. It lends itself very well, I think, in human resource programs.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Sarah Beyer, I think in the past, one of the things that has bogged some of this down is the sense that the one size fits all, that if we're going to do it, absolutely everybody is going to do it. What we sometimes do then is it gets watered down and we get caught up in trying to get it some agency or program that does lend itself more to an activity measure than a real outcome. And so I think taking the pilot approach and focusing in allows us to kind of at least keep that limited and then talk about how would you expand from there.
So I take it from your presence that the Secretary of State's office and the Executive Department is very interested in following through on these pilots.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think both Freeze and I, who have been through these kinds of things for many, many years, would like to see have again the opportunity to see if we can make it work in Oregon. This would not cost us anything because it would be part of our normal audit process. I think in the long run, though, if the legislature wants to pursue performance budgeting, they're going to have to put the resources into it. We have, when I started in the legislative fiscal office in 1988, we began the process of putting together a statewide accounting system, a modern accounting system. We're only now getting that in place in 1998. We are now working on a new budget system, and we piloted that this time, and we'll try to move it out, I guess, to all agencies next time. So it takes time to put these kinds of things in place. The new budget system, they piloted it. It's a computerized budgeting process. And I think that you need that kind of piloting in order to see what works and what doesn't work. And that's why I'm supportive of this approach, because it is a pilot. It's not trying to do all things for all people. And it gives us the opportunity to see if something can work.
Senator Beyer.
Mr. Teresa, just one comment. We've been focusing on the Dash 5 amendments. The rest of the bill is fine, since it essentially specifies the system law, which we're already doing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes. As we look at the basic part of the bill, it does some extension because it talks about the entire budget, which we don't necessarily do that now, but it is not dissimilar from the current process. So it is something that at this point we don't see any problems with implementing if it helps the legislature get better information and get it a little bit earlier, perhaps.
You may be jumping to a big conclusion that will help. But
we'll do that. Anyone else care to testify on the bill? We thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3182.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I would move the -A5 amendments.
Senator Beyer has moved the -A5 amendments to House Bill 3182. Any discussion? Any objection? Not so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3182 as amended to the floor for dispatch.
Senator Barr has moved House Bill 3182 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Starr?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, House Bill 3182 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Beyer, will you carry? Sure. Senator Beyer will carry. That, we close the work session on House Bill 3182, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3410. And we call John Chandler forward.
And a good one.
And a good one, too.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs of the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on House Bill 3410. This bill was introduced to correct a court decision. We introduced the bill in 1997, this legislature passed, dealing with clear and objective standards for aesthetic regulation. That sounds like a s'more, I understand. The problem we were having was that local governments were regulating for aesthetics and appearance in a way that was impossible to comply with. The state law had required clear and objective standards for needed housing that was overlooked oftentimes. In the testimony in 1997, we were brought forward a number of local ordinances, including one which, and it's almost a direct quote, in order to cite a multifamily project, you had to demonstrate that the project enhanced the civic vigor of the community. That seemed like a difficult standard. We thought maybe a number of Boy Scout troops per apartment house or something like that. We got brought the bill in 97 that said, and I quoted it in the written material in front of you, that the local government can attach only clear and objective approval standards or special conditions, regulating appearance or aesthetics to an application, so on and so on. We thought that was pretty clear. That's what we were getting at. Unfortunately, the Land Use Board of Appeals got a hold of a case and essentially voided the statute that was passed in 97. House Bill 3410 is an attempt to underline for the courts that what it was the legislature meant and that be a little more clear. The first thing LUBA did was they held that the clear and objective standard only applied if the only thing they were regulating was aesthetics. In other words, if the local government was attempting to regulate aesthetics plus anything else, then they could do so in a vague and fuzzy manner. That is not what the intention was in 1997. House Bill 3410 clarifies that by stating regulating aesthetics in whole or in part to make it clear what the intention was. Second thing LUBA did, there's a process in Oregon law that allows when an applicant turns in an application for development, the local government has 30 days to tell them what they need in addition to what was already turned in. It's called the completeness check. LUBA said that in the event that the ordinance was vague and subjective, they could clarify it, the local government could clarify it through the completeness check. In other words, according to LUBA's ruling, they could either have an ordinance that said you must enhance the civic vigor of the community, and then the local government have 30 days in which to flesh that out for you and tell you what it was they meant. That is not the intention, or was not the intention of the law in 1997. What we've said here is that the ordinance has to be clear on its face, clear and objective on its face. In other words, we don't get to adopt at the local level vague and fuzzy ordinances with the details to follow. That's unfair to the applicant, it's unfair to the process. And finally, LUBA held that the local government, or the applicant had the burden of proving that the ordinance was not clear and objective. We believe, and I think the proper interpretation would have been, that the local government has the burden of showing that their ordinance is clear and objective, not the other way around. Otherwise, the applicant is placed very much in a position of proving a negative. 3410 passed by a nice margin in the House. We believe it's a good bill. It helps clarify a law that's very necessary, and we would encourage you to send it before the due pass. Glad to take any questions.
Any questions?
Doesn't appear to be any questions.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, also speaking in support of 3410. I had the dubious distinction of being the attorney involved in the LUBA opinion that resulted in this bill. John Chandler gave a good explanation of what the bill does. I would just simply point out, and I won't add to what John said, I'll just simply point out that the importance of this bill is in that it makes it possible, whereas currently it is impossible for us, my developer members, Don's members, maybe some of Don's members, to provide needed housing in local governments or in communities, particularly if local governments have acidic criteria and want to try and stop that. Without this bill, it's relatively easy, or it would be relatively easy for a local government to simply adopt acidic criteria that were impossible to meet or so overly burdensome that it was cost prohibitive and made it impossible for folks to provide needed housing. So we think this is a critical bill, a must bill, good bill to pass. Any questions, you'd be happy to answer.
Senator Meyer?
Could you give me an example of where you thought they were? I guess I don't exactly understand what was going on in Ashland in the case and what would be clear and objective standards.
I can, Chair Starr, Senator Byer, I can give you a thumbnail of what happened in Ashland. The city of Ashland passed the Hillside Development Ordinance. And the Hillside Development Ordinance regulated development. Ashland essentially sits in a bowl. The Hillside Development Ordinance regulated development along the areas outside of the bottom of the bowl. They had a number of criteria regulating things such as the color of the house. You had to paint your house in an earth tone color, and then they limited development. They had footprint sizes, and they required geotech reports, and they required reports from certified arborists, and they required reports from landscape professionals, and so there was a whole series of requirements that were in place before you could develop in any of the hillside development areas. The purpose of the Hillside Development Ordinance, according to the city, was twofold: aesthetics, the protection of aesthetics, and some geotech, some safety requirements, which is fine. But we had a hard time believing that when you were talking about what color you were going to paint your house, you were really concerned with safety hazards. Those were more aesthetic criteria. And yet so there was an appeal filed essentially on the grounds that the areas that they were regulating were in their needed housing inventory, and it would be impossible to provide needed housing in those areas as a result of the ordinance. It just made it too expensive to provide needed housing. LUBA agreed and remanded, but at the same time they also made some rulings that essentially, and the worst ruling, as far as I'm concerned, was the one that said as long as the ordinance has some other objective, whether it's stated or not, besides aesthetic regulation, then it doesn't need to be clear and objective. Well, any land use planner worth their salt come up with more than one purpose for an ordinance, even if it's, its primary purpose is the regulation of aesthetics. And with that ruling, essentially that meant that none of the aesthetic criteria needed to be clear and objective. And so, because you can always come up with some alternative motivation for passing the ordinance. And as a result, essentially then there would never be any need for aesthetic criteria to be clear and objective simply because you've come up with some type of alternative rationale for passing.
So you weren't objecting to the authority of a local government to impose aesthetic standards, just if they did, they had to be clear and objective. Right. Here's the example of Ashland of requiring an earth tone color, so I would think that's fairly clear and objective. You could know it. I mean, using John's example, if someone said you had to use earth tone colors, and I suppose you could put a pellet out there, but you pretty much know what those are. You may not like them, but you know what they are. Is that the objective of this thing? If you put it out there, make it clear?
Mr. Chairman, think about it, absolutely. We don't object at all to regulating for aesthetics, but what we do object to is aesthetic standards that are impossible to meet because they're so vague. Let me give you an example from 1997 where we had testimony in from an apartment house developer in the metropolitan area, and I will leave the jurisdiction valid and the developer's name out because it's at this point somewhat hearsay. But the gist of their testimony was they were attempting to site a multifamily project in an area zoned for multifamily, and they got heckled to death by a design review board until they said to cave in and build single-family housing, which is not necessarily what it was better for the metropolitan area in terms of increasing density and saving land. And the reason they had done that was they were faced, that was one of the jurisdictions that had the civic vigor language in their code. They were also required to demonstrate that they did not, was compatible with the surrounding area, which was another test. And what happens when you have those kind of standards is you bounce around internally. Yeah, in between, usually a jurisdiction that has those will have a design review board or an architectural board or some similar entity, and you can end up bouncing back and forth between that board and the planning commission and with trying to comply with something that you don't know until, as in this particular case, you get the hint and you drop the project and do something different.
Under your interpretation of what you're proposing here, if we were talking about the city of Sisters, and one of their aesthetic standards would be that any structure must be of Western flavor, I can think of a better word, would that fit?
Mr. Chairman, whether or not I would buy off on Western flavor, I don't know, but I certainly think Sisters ought to be able to allow to say what Western flavor is. That falls front to extending X amount of feet over or whatever. I mean, we're not trying to make the local governments do a bunch of hoops here, but simply if they want earth tones, then they should have a palette that says, here are the colors that we want. Now, we can fight all day long about whether or not that's a good policy decision at the local level. You can also argue about whether or not Sisters does or doesn't look like an old West town. But if they want to do that, they certainly can and should be allowed to. What we don't believe they should be allowed to do is to put up standards that we cannot meet because we don't know what they mean. And that buys you appeals internally, it buys you the trip to Luba. And too often, and the reason I mentioned the story from 97, too often it is used as a way of eliminating or discouraging lesser, in quotes, desirable housing types like multifamily. Because it's rare to see a jurisdiction with a single-family design ordinance, although the city of Portland is sorting around with one. It is not rare at all to see them on a multifamily housing, and oftentimes they have a legitimate purpose of making sure it does fit the community. There are oftentimes more ulterior motives, so we're trying to pester them into going someplace else.
Other questions?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner, here on behalf of Manufactured Housing Association, to seek in favor of this legislation. I thought this had been the law for more than 20 years. When Senator Courtney and Senator Beyer were in city government, I believe that land use ordinances were required to have clear and objective standards when they were dealing with needed housing, housing that had been identified by the city as needed. Essentially, it requires that the city tell the permit applicant in advance what is going to be required. I mean, what a concept. That concludes my remarks.
Other questions?
Thank you very much. Yeah. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3410. Open work session on House Bill 3410.
Mr. Chair, I would move 3410 to close the discussion.
Senator Barr has moved House Bill 3410 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? First call or roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Starr?
Aye. I received the necessary majority. House Bill 3410 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Chair will carry. That we close. Work session on 3410, and we've been through the okay. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2005. Call Larry Harvey and
Kathleen Stevenson Cohen. Thank you.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Larry Harvey, for the record. I'm representing the Cultural Advocacy Coalition. To my left is Kathleen Stevenson Kuhn, who could give you a historical perspective on the issues that are contained in House Bill 2005. The piece of legislation that's before you has pretty very broad support. You'll notice that it's a representative of a variety of different organizations and disciplines throughout the state. It was passed out of the House and has gone through both the all of the policy and substantive committees in the House of Representatives. It's gone through the Ways and Means process already. It was passed out from general government upstairs and received 58 affirmative votes in the House of Representatives just a short time ago. To give you just an overview of what the bill will accomplish, I'll let Kathleen go ahead from here, and then we'll answer any questions you might have.
Good morning. I'm Kathleen Stevenson Kuhn. Glad to be here. This bill, although it seems very simple on the surface, is a very important piece of work that the cultural community is committed to doing. Cultural communities representing heritage, humanities, and the arts all over the state. I've talked to many of you before, so I know I don't have to tell you what arts, heritage, and humanities does in this state. This bill is about creating a legislative task force that will report back to you on how we can preserve our heritage, how we can better bring cultural programs to every citizen of Oregon, how we can do this more efficiently through collaboration, and also how we can plan long-term for the support, financial support of these programs through a cultural trust. I think I'll just stop there unless you have some questions. I think most of you are familiar with this piece of legislation. There would be 9 people on the task force. However, many, many, many people from around the state would be working on committees to bring back a report to you.
Thank you very much. I see from our information we have here that it has been through Ways and Means, and now the Ways and Means recommended that it do pass as amended. We have a subsequent referral indicated with us to Ways and Means. I don't believe that would be necessary to go back to Ways and Means again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you're correct. It has already been through the Ways and Means process, and the, as I said, the subcommittee on general government unanimously passed it up to the full committee, and that full committee passed it out to the House floor. So it is here for your perusal and review. The fiscal impact, as noted, should be $200,000. Now, the bill itself does create a cultural trust investment account. That issue, while it is established in this legislation, this is the enabling legislation, it is not funded through this legislation. So the only fiscal impact that you'd be looking at here would be the monies required to accomplish the goals established in the bill and the subsequent report back to the Legislative Assembly and 71st body.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Anyone else care to testify on House Bill 2005? Not closed public hearing on 2005. And I would like, first of all, a motion to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
So moved.
Senator Barr has moved to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion? Objection? Not so ordered. Go to the floor.
Could we hold this today?
Can we hold it today?
Yeah. I have a possible amendment that I'd like to consider.
Well, sir, since you're one of the required votes to move this thing, we will just hold it for a day. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2005. And we will move on to a consideration of House Bill 3172, and I call in the public hearing and call Stephen Bastick.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Bosak, and I am here on behalf of the Tualatin Hills Parks and Recreation District. I'll be quick and to the point. First of all, I'd like to state that this House Bill 3172 has no effect on the Parks and Recreation District's systems development charges mechanism. We do not base our SBC assessment on the number of new employees hired. It's based on new development, new construction. Second, I would like to state that I believe that current state regulations address that issue, and they also do not allow FTCs to be charged based on number of new employees solely. It's also based on new development, new construction. And lastly, I would like to thank you for your time and thank you for your hard work over the last 6+ months. I know y'all have got a lot of important issues, and I hope that you can get them behind you and start your summers very soon. Thank you.
Questions?
Mr. Byer.
As I missed the first piece you were saying, you're opposed to this?
No, we're neutral. It has no effect on us whatsoever.
As far as I can tell, it doesn't have an effect on anybody.
My understanding also.
Who do you represent?
Tualatin Hills Parks and Recreation District.
That's Parks District and Washington County.
Probably the best parks and rec district in the state.
Thank you. We try.
Any further questions of the witness? We will close the public hearing.
Mr. Chair, is there anybody
anyone else?
Anybody here supporting this?
Anyone then? We have no other witnesses signed up. Anyone else desire to ask on House Bill 3172?
There's the city, 3172. One more.
I don't want to testify about, but I'd like an explanation of why it's here.
You'd have to ask Representative Litt.
You already know that. Yes, and we would be helpful if we had some further explanation of this. Chief Representative Litt is available. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3172 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2658. And we invite Mr. Chandler and Art Slack.
Hi, I'm Art Jr. I just want to say them all right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs of the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on House Bill 2658. Specifically, there are some amendments to this bill, the -4 amendments. Let me just cover quickly what those do, and I'll explain the bill in chief. What the -4 amendments do is insert the word voluntary in line 15 of the printed bill, the A and gross version. And the reason for that is because that word voluntary was lost in the shuffle between the -2 and -3 amendments in the House the language in section 2, sub 2 of the printed bill was written by Metro as a part of our negotiations on the House side, and the word voluntary was eliminated, so it would be, with the dash 4 amendments, would read in line 15, or other voluntary regulation, provision, or condition. What the bill does, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is address the issue of inclusionary zoning. And inclusionary zoning is a term of art that generally relates to a practice where local government would, as part of the approval conditions for a subdivision, require that a certain number of units be provided at a reduced price or for sale to a certain income level. This is a fairly new practice in Oregon. It has been used in other parts of the country. We feel that it's important that the legislature state that it's not going to be the practice in Oregon. And we're saying this not because we don't believe in affordable housing, but we do. In fact, the building industry won't take a back seat to anybody in terms of our support for affordable housing. But we don't believe that any one industry should be picked out or singled out as the solution for the problem. What the measure says now is that the local government cannot do that unless it is incentive-based, density bonus, market-driven, voluntary. Some combination of that to make it clear that if it's a societal problem, which affordable housing certainly is, it should be a societal solution. If it's going to be done by the builder or developer, it should be done in a voluntary way. And that can be done. We're not trying to preclude local government or stop them from being creative. There are hanging the bell around somebody else's neck doesn't qualify as creative. You can use density bonuses, that's been discussed, where in exchange for a certain price range, you can get increased units to build. We have no problem with that. One of the other ideas on the table is that if in exchange for a certain price range of sale, you get a faster processing time, or you get to move to the front of the line for a particular annexation, and we have no problem with that. What we have a problem with was, as what the Metro Council was playing with doing here a few months ago, a program which would say that we had to have a certain number of units at a certain price range without government subsidy. The reality is that for the lowest of the low income, even up to the fairly moderate income housing, it is going to require a government subsidy of some sort in order to make that happen because the private sector simply cannot get to those markets. And if the language of an ordinance says it's going to be done without government subsidy, I don't think it requires a great deal of imagination to find out who is going to provide that subsidy. The purpose of 2658 is to make it clear that we will be part of the solution, but we will not be the solution, and we would encourage local governments to think in terms of ways that make it a win-win as opposed to a punitive measure. There are a couple things I'd like to put on the record, Mr. Chairman, if I may. One is at the request of Metro, who wanted to make it clear that the voluntariness of this did not restrict the ability of Metro to require governments within their jurisdiction to provide ordinance allowing voluntary measures. In other words, Metro has a charter which says that those jurisdictions within the Metro boundary are subject to the functional plan developed by Metro. Metro wants to make sure that they have the ability to require the Beavertons, the Portlands, the Greshams to set up an ordinance allowing for voluntary inclusionary zoning. We have no problem with that. The intention of the bill was the voluntariness should be on the part of the developer and builder, not necessarily on government. And a related point I'd like to make clear, which I believe Mr. Schlack and Mr. Bell will also speak to, is that this is not intended to provide a free pass for a state agency to get around their major 30 obligations by requiring local government to do something that's going to cost local government money without providing the commensurate assistance under major 30. We think that, and that again is not the intent of the bill. We have no problem with that interpretation. I forget that would be a logical interpretation of the legislation. We have a great deal of concern about affordable housing. We have brought several bills forward this session in attempting to deal with that. This bill is also an attempt to deal with that because it makes it clear that we are not going to solve the problem on the back of one industry or the back of one segment of the population. It does raise the profile, I believe, to be able to be discussing affordable housing. We hope the 2658 will aid in that discussion by focusing it on measures that will actually have a chance of success as opposed to litigation. One final point, Mr. Chairman, and I'll close and take questions. It's my opinion, as an attorney, that inclusionary zoning, as is was being proposed by Metro and other jurisdictions would hardly be unconstitutional under the recent Supreme Court test set out in the Nolan versus California Coastal Commission and Dolan versus City of Tigard. That has not been tested any place in the country, although the people from, we have a group from Maryland that came out last year at the request of Metro to discuss inclusionary zoning, where Maryland's been doing that for some time. And it was the opinion of at least a couple folks in that panel, including one government representative from the city of Maryland, that they probably could not adopt their practice today under the Supreme Court's test. There was also the opinion expressed on the record in the House by the general counsel for Metro that he agreed with my interpretation that if the local government were to adopt a measure that had no incentives whatsoever for the builder, that that probably should still get a successful challenge under the Constitution. We hope you'll agree that 2150A is a good policy for the state and pass it on to the due pass. We'll take any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon County. And I guess I'm here more to express a concern at this point than I am to oppose the bill at this point or to support it. County's concern at this point with the bill is we haven't seen this as a problem. No county is doing this, but Mr. Chandler indicates that jurisdictions have talked about it. They haven't actually adopted any ordinances or rules that would require inclusionary zoning at this point. But we all operate under a mandate, if you will, of providing affordable housing. And so this may be limiting our ability somehow. I'm not sure exactly how that is. But on one hand, we say you can't require inclusionary zoning. We have the mandate for affordable housing. And we have, you can do something if you can come up with incentives. Well, the bag of incentives sometimes is limited, and local government can push the envelope in some respects, but can't always get there. Our concern is that we are tying housing even more so to, in the land use planning process, with the recent adoption of periodic review modifications at this point. So the housing department will be involved to a larger extent. And our concern is that with this legislation, there may be the opportunity where either DLCD or the housing authority will come forward and mandate or require local governments to do more or require more incentives, because they will say we're not meeting our affordable housing requirements. And this is a problem. This is kind of like, on one hand, we're saying, yeah, there's a problem we need to address and have a statement. We would feel more comfortable if it was very clear that state agencies at this point could not come and require local governments to adopt incentives to meet some kind of affordable housing requirements that we are not aware of at this point in time. So that's our concern, Mr. Chair.
Question?
Senator Dwyer.
It's an interesting dilemma.
Yes.
Pardon. It strikes me what you're saying is that, you know, you're concerned about the impact of any restriction on the state maybe imposing something else. But I guess the other one is, I think you hit on it, it's the question if we're going to set a societal goal. Should we socialize the cost of that across the entire state or the entire community, or should we try and impose that upon a single development or single class? Because I guess I would look at it and say it's really not the building community who's going to pay that cost. It's going to be the people who are buying those houses who are going to pay that cost. So for the right to buy a $200,000 house, they may have to kick in $10,000 for somebody else's house. Whereas the rest of the citizens, under this kind of interpretation, the rest of the citizens of the community wouldn't have any responsibility at all.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think it is an interesting dilemma. On one hand, we've indicated that there's an indication that if you do density bonuses, that you could potentially do some inclusionary zoning. In other words, so what I understand is that if I had a project that had 100 dwelling units, and I did an incentive to allow 110 on those 10, the additional, I could require those to be moderate or low-income housing, not necessarily putting a dollar
but say they would be available to moderate to low-income housing and let the market then establish whatever that market price is as long as those people could qualify. You know, to, and so you're not saying X dollars, but you're saying they're available to a range. I think it's more of a, it impacts actually the entire community because increased densities, you know, it affects, and if you do some of these things, yes, some of the housing units, you know, that are available to other people where the market has set the price may be higher to make up for the lower, especially if you're saying within this development, I have to have an average cost, you know, per housing unit of X. So if some are lower, then some are going to be higher to get to that average. So I think the entire community is going to actually have to respond to that affordable housing goal as a community at this point.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Philip Fell from the League of Oregon Cities, and I certainly agree with the points that Art has made, although we take it a little farther. We oppose House Bill 2658. The issue here is how do you have adequate housing? The proponent has suggested that it ought not to be on the backs of the industry, and in fact, we agree. We don't think it's on the back of the industry now. We think there are substantial public subsidies to allow home construction to continue and increase in the state. Those costs are borne in good part by the existing residents of the city. Fully half of all the money we spend on roads is money that we raise locally. That money helps subsidize the construction of infrastructure that is not paid for by SDCs. Virtually nobody, although if there are a couple, I'm sure Mr. Chandler can tell us which communities charge the full cost through their SDCs. We think there is a public subsidy. There's a community goal, as expressed by the state and locally, that we want to be able to have some impact on the shape of our community. This is an important goal to the state and to cities, and we urge you to reject this. We think it's
Other questions?
Thank you. We're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2658. And I want to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3172 and ask Representative Witt to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Bill Witt. House Bill 3172 passed the House 6 or 8 weeks ago. I now have being put in front of you dash two amendments to this bill. What the bill is designed to do is to say that government units that impose systems development charges upon employers may only do so based upon, by using a methodology that is based upon some type of construction or change use of a facility, not simply on the number of employees or the fact that the corporation or the employer has hired additional employees. What the dash two amendments do is they would insert on line 16 after the word development, just before the word buy, or new use of an existing structure by an employer. So it says that no systems development charges may be imposed upon an employer, nor may there be any methodology that imposes those charges on an employer based upon the number of employees without regard to new construction, new development, or new use of an existing structure by an employer. This bill came forth because of concerns that some of the methodologies that were being considered by special districts or other government entities that use systems development charges we're considering methodologies that would be based simply upon the number of employees or by the simple fact of hiring additional employees, where it would not be directly related to some kind of changes in facilities, such as construction or the changed use of the facility by the employer. And as I indicated, this bill passed the House and, of course, is now here in front of you. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm trying to figure out exactly where you're going with this one. To my knowledge, nobody uses employment, but they do use, for traffic STCs, I think it's fairly common, people use a use category. I guess an example would be if you had a building that was a warehouse, and all of a sudden it changed to, and this is stretching it, but a McDonald's. For determining the amount of traffic, you can have a significant difference in use. As you're interpreting or you're intended here, would that cover that, the change of use, or?
I think it would, Senator. I think the existence of the Dash 2 amendments would incorporate the possibility of having an SDC because it would be a new use of an existing structure.
Couldn't you see that in some cases where you would change your use, it could significantly have an impact on transportation?
Yes.
It would be demanded? So somebody could be, the notion of an SDC is that people, each use is supposed to pay its own way. You could have a change of use which could put a situation where somebody wasn't indeed paying their own way.
I think the Dash 2s would incorporate the illustration that you're giving there, Senator, so that you could, I think in the language of the bill with the Dash 2s, you could impose an SDC under those circumstances.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryan, Representative, you were mentioning that some special districts were thinking about imposing this type of a system.
Yeah.
Could you give us an example of who that was and why?
Well, you know, there seems to be a little confusion on what they were considering and where this ultimately went, but this originated because of information I got in terms of Tualatin Hills Park and Recreation District and methodologies that they were considering in terms of the imposition of SDC charges upon employers. Now, they ended up coming to the House committee that heard this bill originally and said that the language of 3172 would not change what they were doing because they were within the parameters of 3172. That was not my understanding going into it, going into the hearing, or certainly I was under the belief that they were considering a different methodology or a different approach in terms of imposing SDC charges. But they testified at that hearing that their actual practices still were within the confines of 3172. And if that's fine, that's great. What 3172 then does is it puts some specific clear boundaries as to where SDCs can be imposed upon employers.
Mr. Chair, I suppose what we're seeing or will see are just creative ways for local governments to raise money with the imposition of Measure 5 and then Measure 47 and 50. This is one that hasn't quite gotten over the mountains yet to central and eastern Oregon, but I don't think imposing this type of assistance charge would be within the parameters of Measure 5 or Measure 47 and 50. So we'll probably be seeing some more of these.
Senator Barr? I guess we're a little bit into discussion, but the way the SDC law is written now, you can only use SDCs for capital construction and only for things that were in a plan that was adopted as part of the local ordinance. And it has to bear a relationship. I think you've got kind of a Dolan situation where you really couldn't, I don't think you could make an adaptation that didn't have a bear a relationship to the impact.
So they couldn't use it for operating expenses? They
can't use it for operating expenses. You're going to use it for expansion. Either expansion or services are paying back for an expansion done in anticipation.
Thank you. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Witt, I need you to help me out philosophically. I have this general view that I'm sure is violated from time to time in the eyes of some, that we should preserve the notion of as much local control as is possible, which extends to the idea that local governments, local taxing authorities perhaps should have the freedom to be as enlightened or as stupid as they must care to be without us interjecting our opinion. Tell me, what is the necessity for us to intervene in this particular situation?
Senator, I think that the legislature certainly has a responsibility to preserve at least a minimal uniform climate, economic climate, and tax climate in the state of Oregon, and whereby businesses and employers and individuals can anticipate a fairly uniform and fair treatment in terms of how they are taxed and regulated. Now, we do certainly recognize that from district to district, city to city, county to county, there's different influences and interests and pursuits that allow for some variation. But I think in view of the fact that these systems development charges are imposed specifically for, as Senator Byers said, capital improvement, that we should make sure there's some logical nexus between the imposition of those charges and the purpose for which they are used. And if a special district or a taxing district imposed SDCs simply upon the number of employees or the fact that a business is hiring additional employees, I think that nexus is really no longer there in a rational or reasonable way. But instead, as it has traditionally been, those charges have been tied into some kind of change in the use of a facility or new construction that creates a logical nexus in terms of demands upon the system, such as a park district or a fire district. So for those reasons, I think to keep that uniform system and to make sure there's some logical nexus, I think this legislation makes sense.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Questions? Thank you, Representative Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate bringing this measure to us. With that, I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3172. We have heard testimony now on the three measures, which we have not yet taken action on. I'm going to not open a work session on these measures at the moment, and instead I'm going to go ahead and open I'm going to open up a work session on executive appointments, and we have several individuals who have David Hegert, who's been appointed to the Energy Facility Siting Council. Mr. Hegert, if you come forward, please. Tell us why you desire to be on the Energy Siting Council.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is David Taggart. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to appear before you regarding my appointment to the Energy Facility Siting Council. I've had a long interest in being on the Facility Siting Council, and I've been very active in energy issues in Oregon. I have served for total of 18 years on the small-scale energy program for Oregon, guiding it from its initial inception until I left the committee about 2 years ago. I am a consultant, and I have experience in economics, feasibility studies, and marketing and information services. On page two of what I have, of the handouts, you'll see a list of clients that I have, that I have done market and other studies for. On page three, you'll see a list of some of the community service activities that I've been involved in over the last 20 years.
Thank you. Is there a question, Mr. Target? If not, I would entertain a motion to move his nomination forward.
Sure, I'd move that Mr. Taggart nomination to the appointed Energy Facility Siting Council be brought to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. I guess you don't need due pass. We move to the floor of the Senate.
Thank you very much. Senator Bryant has moved the appointment of David Taggart to the Energy Facility Siting Council.
With recommendation
with
the appointment be confirmed.
With recommendation that the appointment be to the Senate floor, with the recommendation that the appointment be confirmed. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Chair Cox.
Aye. I receive the necessary majority. The nomination is moved to the Senate floor with recommendation to be approved. Thank you very much, sir. With that, we've closed that hearing, and we request Mark Davalos come forward. Is Mark here? Mark not here? If not, we will call Theda Varis, who's appearing a appointee to the trustees of the State Library.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm Frida Barth, and I have been appointed to serve as a trustee of the State Library Board. And I believe you have the information that I submitted with regard to my interests and my experience. I've been very actively involved with the library in Corvallis for the last 10 years, serving on in various capacities as the campaign coordinator and most recently as chair of the library board there. And I've also been involved at the state level with the LSTA advisory board, which is the grant decision-making group as to the different local libraries throughout the state when they apply for federal money. And have also worked on an Oregon Library Services Work Group on an interim or subcommittee, joint interim committee of education. So this has been a real interest to me. I consider it a real opportunity to be able to serve the state of Oregon in this way, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you very much. Sure. Any questions? If not, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bryant.
I would move that Frida Varis go to the floor with recommendation the appointment be confirmed.
Senator Bryant has moved the appointment of Frida Varis to the trustees of the State Library. He moved the floor with recommendation to pass. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Chair Stark.
Aye. Receive the necessary majority. The appointment of three of ours to the trustees of the State Library has moved to floor with the recommendation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we're moving right along. Called Gary Drummond, appointee to the Board of Commissioners of the Port of Portland.
Mr. Drummond.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gerard Drummond. I live in Clackamas County on a farm near Canby. My prior career consisted of practicing law in the Portland area for the firms that are now consolidated as part of Stoll Reeves. 1977, became the chief executive officer of a company called Nerco Inc., which was a mining and resource development company, at that time wholly owned by Pacific Corp., subsequently a public company. That company was sold in 1993, and I retired. My public sector involvement consists of having served as the chairman of the board of TriMet for approximately 12 years, and then serving on the Oregon Investment Council since 1987. I was chair of the council from 1990 till my term expired in 1998. I've also been involved in a number of civic activities in the Portland area, as well as serving on the Oregon Shakespeare Festival Board in Ashland. I believe the continued success of the Port of Portland is vital to the economic well-being of the metropolitan area as well as the state of Oregon, and think that my prior business and professional experience as well as my community involvement could be of value to the commission. And thank you, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Questions for Mr. Drummond? Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would like to get a feel as to your view as to terms and the meaning of that word. A term is for 4 years in the case of your appointment. Would you expect that at some time after the conclusion of those 4 years you would either be renominated or encourage someone to recognize where time had expired and somebody else should be nominated?
My understanding is that I would expect to either be re-nominated or somebody would be appointed to sit in my seat. I actually did sit on the Investment Council for somewhat over a year after the expiration of my term until the governor appointed my successor and she was confirmed by the Senate. That's my experience, and I don't know whether the rules pertaining to the port differ from that or not.
Further question. That would be, do you have a sense, based on your own personal experiences and background, as to what's a reasonable time frame for a subsequent appointment to be made or a reappointment?
I have 30
days, 60 days.
I have no beliefs on that subject, Senator. I really don't know what's appropriate.
So, in this, I see that the current president of the Port of Portland is actually, that term expired, I believe, over a year ago. Is that at all problematic?
I don't know if it's problematic or not. I don't know if that impacted the business of the port.
Would you suggest perhaps that it abuses this process?
I really have no opinion on the subject, Senator. I understand from reading the newspaper that there is controversy between the Senate and the governor's office, but I really am not in a position to take, have no knowledge that gives me an ability to take a position on it.
Clearly, you must have some observation there. I can't believe you're going into this particular appointment saying you've read about the controversy and have no personal opinion. I can understand trying to avoid one, but I can't understand not having one.
I think it's an interesting legal question, Senator, and I'm not in a position to render an opinion on it. I really haven't studied the issue that carefully.
With the effect of not making reappointments is to continue people in office well beyond their terms, I guess what I'm trying to discover is the point of anyone coming before this particular committee in the appointments process itself. If it can be defeated by delay or just failing to submit people either for appointment or reappointment, what's the point?
I'm probably not the person to ask that question of, Senator. I really don't have an opinion.
Well, let me know your opinion about this, then, if I might. Suppose that you came before the Senate for reappointment, and suppose the Senate rejected your reappointment. Would you continue to serve?
I'd have to consider that very carefully. I think if the representatives of the people of the state of Oregon did not want me to serve in a position on a public body, my own view is that I probably would resign at that point. But that's a personal view. And, I mean, it doesn't represent a legal opinion, if you will.
What would you, as a well-regarded lawyer, could you offer some legal advice on that?
Senator, I haven't practiced law since 1976, and I don't have an active ticket, so I won't render legal opinion. Sure.
I thought Mr. Drummond was here because he's been appointed to serve in the Port of Portland, and that's what we're about. Whether or not there is somebody else on the Port of Portland who belongs there, should be there, has the merit, or doesn't have the merit, I don't know why this witness should be grilled about that particular consequence or that particular controversy. I thought the merits or demerits of him, whether or not he belongs or doesn't belong, in terms of his appointment, is what this committee is all about. I've never served in this committee before, except in the last few weeks. It's the first time I've ever been a part of a committee that deals with appointments. When I went to the Senate, the first time I had been a part of the appointment process. So I don't know why Mr. Drummond is being grilled on this particular issue, since I don't think it speaks to whether or not he has the qualification, the experience, the knowledge to be on the Port of Portland.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer that for the new member. And that is that if a nominee for whatever position comes before this body and tells us, in effect, they don't care much for our view, whether we confirm them, whether we reject them, that they might have the impression they would just continue on, even if after their nomination came to the floor and it was rejected. Now, frankly, I think that says something about the quality of the nominee. Sure. I'm not particularly interested in supporting people who don't care much about our judgment.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that question was asked of three preceding witnesses as to whether or not they would serve on the circumstances. These questions are reserved just for this particular witness, which I find very interesting. And the fact that he is here, the fact that the man has come here and subjected him to this jurisdiction of this committee, I think speaks volumes as to the respect he has for this process, this committee, and the Senate as an institution.
Appreciate that. I regret not asking the other witnesses, which is something I have done in other hearings. But I'd be happy to try to ascertain their point of view. It'll make you feel like that. I'm sure it will. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. So much the testimony. The other reappointee to the Board of Commissioners, Port of Portland, is not appearing today. We do have a further member appearing, Port of Portland, appearing Thursday or Friday.
And Ms. Aaron's materials are at 10:05.
Ms. Chairman, on that, or I would like to invite her to be here. Yeah, when she can. I see you've got parents waived, but I would respectfully request that she be here. We will we'll check that with her and make that known.
Chair, if I might make a comment.
Please.
Thank you. I'm Katie Koba, Director of Executive Appointments with the Governor's Office. Cheryl Perrin had been scheduled as at a prior hearing, and her appearance has been waived. I think there was some confusion on her part, and she was actually on her way to Salem before she realized that her appearance was waived. It's been somewhat of a problem in terms of scheduling, and I guess I would respectfully request that we move forward on her consideration this morning with Jerry German. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair.
Senator Miller,
just so that we can gauge her respect for this committee, and also as a matter of past practice, I would say that you obviously can run this any way you so choose, but when I've chaired for 4 years, I would simply grant appearance waivers unless any member of the committee, regardless of their affiliation, requested a witness appear. That request is always granted. I would suggest that's good policy.
Mr. Chair. Senator Clark, as a new member, could you help me? I guess I asked Senator Barrett, what do you mean by waived? Your appearance was waived.
Show up and go through this as you suggest.
No, but really. But waived in the sense that they were given permission. Would you explain to me how that happens? So they given permission or?
That's correct.
By who?
By the chair.
Oh, okay. And you gave her permission. Oh, okay.
And I would just, if I might, okay. Chair, just say past practice, I used to do the same thing as chair, but I came to the hearings and I said if any member disagreed with that waiver, then I would invite that witness to come forward.
I understand.
Chair, Senator Bryant, if the chair's desire to go ahead and move Mr. Drummond's appointment to the floor today.
I would move the
I would
the appointment. Yeah, I appreciate that, and we could do that.
Sure, I would then move that Mr. Drummond's appointment to the Port of Portland go to the floor with a recommendation that the appointment be confirmed.
Okay, that's right. Do we move on?
No, we've done them individually. So.
Yeah, okay.
We have a motion by Senator Bryant to move the appointment of Gary Drummond to the Board of Commissioners of the Court of Portland to the floor with recommendation that the appointment be confirmed. Further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant?
Aye.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator Miller?
No.
Chair Starr?
Aye. I received the necessary majority of Gary Drummond's appointment to the Board of Commissioners, Port of Portland. Then move the floor of recommendation appointment be confirmed. Mr. Chairman, I might have just, again, for Senator Courtney, Senator, and perhaps others, we just happened to get a book about 2-3 weeks ago on confirmations, just so you would know that during the last 2 years, I believe, we confirmed about 98.5% all the appointees, even after they were subjected to these very difficult drillings. But I'd also suggest one of the things this committee ought to be aware of is that there are currently 38 appointees who are serving well past their terms, including one who is over 3 years past the expiration of that term. And I think we ought to reflect a little bit on the lack of respect that the executive has for this process. And if the executive wants to get us out of the appointment business, probably ought to suggest some legislation to do it.
Well, as I understand, though, the New York court seems to do some, at least on one particular point, there is a proceeding in court besides the jurisdictions, he's three cycle jurisdictions, isn't that correct? And he's moving him with all due speed, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. I think he's only 2 years back.
But isn't that true, though, that we are, it's been AG opinions, and we are trying to get that resolved one way or other in terms of some of these jurisdictional discussions and things like that. Isn't that right or am I wrong?
Right. As you know, two past attorney generals say that that individual should not be serving, but we'll see.
And could be we do need legislation to clarify the jurisdiction of the
And I would agree with, I think it's a fair question that Senator Miller asked about if you were rejected by the Senate, whether or not you'd continue to serve with us. And I think that is a fair question to ask any person before the body.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Sorry to keep interrupting. Again, Katie Koba, Director of Executive Appointments with the Governor's Office. Senator Miller just made a comment about appointees serving past their term and mentioned 35. We need to clarify that 10 of those 35 are sufficient to Senate confirmation. The others are boards and commissions that do not require Senate confirmation. The one that he mentioned that is serving over 3 years past his term, appointee to the Water Resources Commission, and there was an agreement between the governor and the Senate that that candidate would continue to serve for 4 years past his term expiration. The others that are mentioned are probably less than 6 months past their term expiration.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
And, Mr. Chair, I will confirm the agreement on the Water Resource Commission. I was part of that negotiation, and that was the agreement that was reached with the Senate President's Office as far as him continuing and then two other people being appointed for other seats. So that particular holdover, or however we phrase it, was with the consent of the Senate leadership.
There's not a way of avoiding a reappointment. What's the purpose?
Well, the purpose was to avoid a political fight on the reappointment. At the same time, had two members through the state Water Resource Commission that who had wide, broad support and are good members. So it was a political compromise.
Thank you. Has Mark Avalos returned to the room? With that, I'm going to close the executive appointment proceedings and move to a work session on House Bill 2757 and
Which one did you say?
House Bill 2757, and it's joined to HJR 28.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't here when the public testimony was taken. I was curious about if there's been any fiscal impact done as far as what the cost would be or potential cost to the state of Oregon. And I didn't see one in the file. My caution in raising this is that before I want to vote on this, I'd like to know if there is a cost and just to see what impact it could possibly have on the state. When this was up in 97, I remember that was generally discussed, and the only one that came to mind was a district attorney's position because the state pays primarily for the district attorney. The deputies are usually picked up primarily by the counties. But there may be others, and I just wanted to have an understanding of that before I cast a vote.
It does have an impact on both the county that was losing the jurisdiction as well as the county that was gaining. Mm-hmm.
So, it could.
Possibility of that. I don't see anything in the...
Maybe staff knows fiscal, if this has gone fiscal.
No. Chair Starr, members of the committee, I don't believe that this has gone fiscal. The intention of both of these bills, as presented by witnesses, was to just have a mechanism in place in the event that Gresham or any other city would like to
seems from that county.
And I can understand that they're interested in doing that. I just want to know what it's going to cost if that happens.
Well, we will direct the inquiry and bring that back to them.
I don't intend to hold up the bill, but I want to be able to have a cast an intelligent vote.
Appreciate that. With that, we'll close the session, and we will adjourn the Senate Rules of Election. And we thank you all for your patience and